Members, today is Monday, March 17th, St. Patrick's Day. I'm not wearing green, but some of you are, so that's great. And the time is 1:03 p.m. I call this meeting of the Health, Finance, and Policy Committee to order. And we have a quorum, members. We have a quorum. So, Representative Rapinski, have you had a chance to look at the minutes from Wednesday, March 12th?
I have, Chair, and I approve them.
Okay, cool. So, Representative Rapinski moves the approval of the minutes for Wednesday, March 12th. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those that are opposed say nay. Okay, the motion prevails and the minutes are approved. Okay, we're going to go to Representative Novotny, but Representative Bierman, you had a
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to take note of the fact that today is Sovereignty Day, a day that was planned quite a while ago. And it's unfortunate we could not accommodate the Sovereignty Day with our health committee for this day. And I think with a little bit of planning, this committee could have adjusted just fine. And our members would be here. So I just want to register that and just say that, there's important bills that we're hearing today, and unfortunately my members are not going to participate, and I just want to register that so that we can do better in the future. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Bierman. The first bill up for today is House File 1903. The chair moves House File 1903 before the committee with the chair's intent to lay the bill over. The chair also adopts the A1 amendment to get the bill in the shape that the author would like.
What's that?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I move to adopt the A1 amendment to get the bill as it should be in shape as Representative Namati wants it. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. The motion prevails and the A1 amendment is as adopted. Okay, Representative Novotny, introduce your bill.
Chair Backer.
Just to let you know, thank you. Sorry to interrupt. We're going to try to do about 10 minutes on your bill today because we got a full house.
I will talk very fast then, Chair.
Thank you.
So I was approached a couple years ago by members of the Elk River Fire Auxiliary. The possibility of getting language changed in the current safe haven law that exists that would allow the use of what's called a safe baby box. And what would be is, we just went through a month of sub-zero temperatures. This would be a way of placing the unborn or the newly born child in compliance with the currently existing Minnesota safe haven laws and having a way that the think of like a book depository or a bank depository that would be available to be installed in a fire department that the baby would be able to be placed in this. There would be several alarms that would go off and cameras, and that would alert emergency services to get the baby out of there so it could transfer the baby in compliance with the current existing Minnesota statutes to a hospital. The amendment, the A1, just cleaned up some of the language that was included. The current law states fire departments, and there are several fire departments like Elk River Station 1 where if this is approved that they would put this in where it's monitored. It's staffed, but not by firefighters. It's staffed full-time by emergency medical technicians that work for the ambulance service, and hopefully that the box would be able to be available if they are on a call. And with that, I would present my two witnesses or testifiers that came with me with the idea, and they are from, as I said, Elk River Fire Auxiliary.
Okay, thank you. Please state your name.
Nicole Hoffman.
And about 2 minutes for your testimony, please.
Already.
Thank you, committee members, for the opportunity to speak in support of House Bill 1903. Like I said, my name is Nicole Hoffman. This is Carly Mayette. We're residents of Elk River, Minnesota, and board members of the Elk River Fire Foundation. I've researched our 25-year safe haven law a lot since seeing the issue of infant abandonment on social media and how there is a nonprofit based out of Indiana making a huge difference on this issue. House Bill 1903 provides positive changes to Minnesota's surrender newborn legislation, creating a less daunting option for surrendering parents. In light of the incidence of illegal and unsafe abandonment in the state of Minnesota, with handfuls of known babies being illegally and or fatally abandoned over the years, it is clear that changes are needed. This bill will most definitely provide for the additional option of complete anonymity for these parents. Existing legislation may help certain parents willing to walk into a safe haven location, but it does not solve the problem of true anonymity. To be clear, confidentiality is not anonymity. For example, a woman delivered her baby at 2 a.m. in a rural area in her state. She called the hotline wanting to utilize a safe haven baby box, but none were available within reasonable distance. She finally agreed to call 911 and have first responders meet her in Walmart parking lot. She surrendered to first responders there, and to her horror, one of the firefighters who showed up on scene was a former high school classmate, validating her deepest fears. And sometimes these deepest fears deter parents from making the decisions they want to make. The outcome of that, babies being found in dumpsters, toilets, alleyways, recycling centers, beaches, landfills, trash compactors, rivers, or in the ground after being buried alive. This bill broadens the scope of Minnesota's law to include the most effective tool in ending infant abandonment, an infant safety device installed in a fire station and hospitals. It's a great tool to encourage adoption over abortion. 21 states to date have enacted laws permitting the use of infant safety devices as a legal form of surrender. South Dakota passed just 2 weeks ago, and 13 states are currently in the works. As of today, 315 baby boxes are installed across the country. These devices have saved 57 infants safely, legally, and kept their parents in crisis truly anonymous. They have a 24-hour National Safe Haven Crisis Line operated by the National Safe Haven Action Coalition. Since the launch of the hotline in March 2016, more than 16,000 calls have been received. Some were given resources when they decided to keep their babies. Some were offered help in choosing an adoption plan, and over 150 were walked through the process of surrendering face-to-face to a safe haven location. Thank you for carefully considering this bill, which will give parents in crisis in Minnesota every available option to do the right thing to keep their baby safe.
Thank you. Thank you. And then we have Miss Mighty.
Mayette, I was going to join in her speech, and she just kept going.
So. You made me nervous when you said 2 minutes, because that was about a three-minute speech, and I didn't want to get
You did fine. But you came here. We would like to, you know, please state your name and share your testimony from the top of your head then.
All right. Well, my name is Carly Mayette. I am also a member of the Elk River Fire Foundation, and Nicole brought the idea to one of our foundation meetings a couple years ago. And I was just moved by the whole organization and looked up our baby law and then contacted Paul to see if we could get the changes needed. Even if it were to save one baby's life, it would really drove me to want to get the changes made, look into fundraising, not cost the state anything because we could take care of it all through fundraising and with our department. And so that is why I'm here, is to hopefully save even one baby's life.
Very good. Thank you. Thank you for sharing that. I open it up to, is there anybody from the public that would like to testify on this for or against this bill? Okay. Seeing none, I close the public testimony and members' discussion. Representative Hewitt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Chair Navanti. Couple of quick questions. One is just getting down to what the problem is in Minnesota here. It sounds like she stated one case, but do you have any idea of what yearly we're looking at here for surrenders that are unknown?
Representative Chair Novotny or Nicole?
I'll handle that as fast as we can, Representative Hewitt. I'll refer you to just a February 5th, 2022. Report from the Duluth Police Department where they had a baby that was surrendered to an advocacy center called Safe Haven. So we think that someone stuck that as someplace that was granted. I'll also point out, and I'll get this in, and I wasn't even aware about this. They pointed out to me that the Department of Public Safety lists the safe haven places that you can drop off a baby, and they list
492 of them.
492 locations in the city, or in the state of Minnesota. They list the Elk River Fire Department as one of the places that you could drop a baby off and be in compliance with the current laws, but it's not current unless we change the language. So we think that is part of the problem, and for no other reason, the Amendment A1 really helps with that.
Representative Hewitt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Chair Navati. The last question I have, and I've heard it more from my side when we talked about this, was the one of the things that's so important when they surrender their children in an anonymous situation is the history of the mother as much as possible. Is there any remedy for that in this situation? Sounds like you testify or no.
So I understand the program very well. So it's a box. When you open the door,
Ms. Hoff, go ahead. You got to be recognized. So no problem.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I know you're eager. Go ahead, Ms. Hoffman.
So the box itself is very technologically advanced. When you open the door, there's actually an informational packet inside where the mother still, if she relinquishes her child there, she can still receive medical care. There's also information about the child, race, ethnicity, date of birth, last name. I mean, they can give as much information as they want and just mail that in anonymously. I mean, it's a very well thought out program. They've been in, I don't want to say business, they've been a nonprofit since 2016 when they started, and they have 100% success rate.
Chair Novotny.
Thank you, Chair Backer. Representative Hewitt, and I'd also like to add that statistics show that more often than not, the mother, when they're placing the baby and they open up the packet, this has led to in-person surrenders more than not.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Close to your bill there, Chair Namani.
Thank you, Chair Backer. This is a good bill. There's good things that we need anyway, despite how you might feel about the use of the boxes or the devices. We still need to clean up the language so that everyone is on the same page. You have to understand that the language is for full-time fire departments, and outside of the large metro areas, that's just not an issue. Or a baby could also be surrendered at a full-time emergency room. Once again, in the rural area, that's just not an issue. And you know, from a personal standpoint for me, I've had seven generations before and after me that I know of that can go back as far as that have been affected very positively by adoptions and surrenders. And it's gone both ways, and it's a good thing. And I appreciate your support.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for bringing this in front of us. Lives matter, so thank you there, Chair Novotny. The chair lays over House File 1903 as amended for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Thank you, and thank you to the testifiers. Members, we are now taking up House File 499. The chair moves House File 499 before the committee with the chair's intent to lay it over, as Representative Zalesikard moves to the table. And when you get there, please introduce yourself and the bill. And our goal is roughly to take about 20, no more than 25 minutes on this bill, please.
Thank you, Chair Backer and members. This bill is really very simple, and it takes a temporary license for nurses, which in the state of Minnesota is allowed to be 60 days, and it moves it to 90 days. And this came about when I started my first session in 2023. I had constituents in my district that approached me that had a nursing license. They graduated from nursing school and moved back to Minnesota and took a job, and their nursing license was not processed in 60 days. They gave me all the records of them submitting all their data, And then I met with the Board of Nursing, who confirmed that, yes, they had received all the data, and it was beyond 60 days. And so what happened in that scenario is you had a nurse that could have been providing patient care at a hospital. In that scenario, sitting on the sidelines. And so I met with the Board of Nursing, and they confirmed they had, in a pandemic, you have a situation where they had a tremendous amount of agency staff coming in from outside areas, but this was still 2023 when I became a first-time legislator. So this was still happening in 2023. And so I worked with the Board of Nursing, and I have the Minnesota is not in a compact, and there are 41 states in Minnesota or in the country that are in the compact. And so I say that because even those states with compacts have longer temporary licenses than Minnesota. So there are 11 states right now, or basically nine states that are not in the compact. And of those nine states, Minnesota has the lowest temporary license. So Minnesota only allows a 60-day. Oregon and Hawaii allow 90 days. Connecticut allows 120 days, and the rest of them are 6 to 18 months. So, members, I think this is a very reasonable bill to allow nurses to be on the bedside at a nursing home, assisted living, disability group home, hospital, for 24-hour operations to make sure that nurses have the support they need, with nurses who have went to school, graduated, and may be licensed in another state and are coming here, or are new grads and want to be at work and not sitting on the sidelines. So I urge you to consider this bill, and thank you.
Thank you, Representative. We now turn to the testifier. Our first testifier is Ms. Teresa Hanu, and that will be first done by Zoom. And we would ask you to keep your comments to that 2 to 3 minutes, please. Ms. Hanu, you're muted.
Can you hear me?
We can hear you and we see you.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to allow me to speak today. My name is Teresa Hanu, and I am the Chief Nursing Officer at Aspira St. Luke's in Duluth, Minnesota. I am here today to express strong support for House File 499, which extends the temporary nursing permit from 60 days to 90 days. This small but critical change directly impacts hospital staffing and ultimately patient care. We are suffering, as you all have heard, a critical nursing shortage, and we are struggling to hire and onboard nurses quickly. When we cannot fill positions, it leads to longer emergency department boarding times, increased left without being seen rates, and a reduced ability to accept patients from our regional hospitals. Patients suffer, but so do the healthcare workers who are working and are already stretched thin. One of the biggest delays in getting new grads, transfer nurses from other states, and even travel nurses to the bedside is our licensing approval process. Often 60 days is not enough time to complete that licensure process, to get background checks, and just to generally onboard folks, especially with our current workforce shortages. I have waited for over 4 months to get two travel nurses in to help our bedside nurses, to help fill those gaps. Extending temporary permits to 90 days buys us valuable time to transition nurses into permanent roles without unnecessary delay. This is a small but actionable step that will help us retain talent, reduce those ED wait times and congestion, and improve patient outcomes. I urge you to support House File 499 to ensure hospitals can staff appropriately and to continue providing high-quality care throughout our state. Thank you for your time.
Thank you so much. Appreciate that. Now, next on the list is Ms. Pula Ruth, and if I mispronounce it, please correct me. So state your name and where you're at, and we ask you to keep your testimony to 2 to 3 minutes, please. Go ahead, please.
I remember last time it didn't work as well. All right. Good afternoon, Chair and members of the committee. My name is Ursula Pula Ruth, and I'm a registered nurse who has worked in labor and delivery for nearly 10 years. I'm testifying today on behalf of Minnesota Nursing Association in opposition to House File 499. Minnesota is a leader in medical treatment and clinical specialties and in healthcare more broadly. The nursing practice in our state is no exception, as we in Minnesota hold very high standards to our nursing practice, not only on the front end in obtaining licensure, but also in the amount of continuing education requirements nurses must adhere to in ever-changing clinical practices. Many out-of-state nurses are not held to the same standards. Continuing education is vital for nurses to provide evidence-based care as it provides safe patient care. I work in high-risk obstetric care, primarily working in labor and delivery, but I also work in antepartum, postpartum, triage. I circulate and scrub in for surgeries and have delivered hundreds of babies, many I've resuscitated. Many out-of-state nurses are not allowed to work in all areas of obstetrics like me. So ask yourself, when you bring a loved one to the hospital, don't you want to know if the nurse is taking care of them is not only a good nurse, but also fully licensed in the state of Minnesota with all the training and education that comes with it? At first glance, this bill may appear to be intended to address a workforce issue, but really this isn't even a temporary fix to solve a real problem. What this bill actually does is target the 15,000 union nurses in Minnesota that are going into contract negotiations starting this month with some of the largest hospital systems in our state. If this became a law, the scales would be even more tilted in favor of the employer in the event of a strike, allowing the hospitals to hire strike breaker nurses for an additional month than what is currently allowed. This bill is an anti-union bill. House File 499 doesn't address the largest issues facing the nursing workforce in our state. If anyone is really looking to solve the problem of recruiting and retaining nurses, whether in a hospital, nursing home, or clinic, the answers you are looking for can be found if you listen to nurses, support them, and put the needs of patients over profits. Safe staffing saves lives, and it saves our careers from burning out. Mr. Chair, committee members, please oppose this bill. Thank you.
Okay, anybody from the public that would like to testify? Okay, seeing none, we're going to turn it over to members' discussion. And it looks like you're back on first on deck there, Representative Hewitt.
Sorry, I picked the right day to stay in committee, I guess, Mr. Chair.
You're just a popular person. Go ahead.
Let's not go there.
Okay, we won't.
Mr. Chair, thank you. And Representative Zlicikar, I really respect your background in administration. However, I also have a background. My whole life has been spent working with nurses. I live with one. There's about 10 nursing schools in the state of Minnesota. Mm-hmm. We have adequate means to do this. Our nurses here, and I've worked with nurses around the country, they're different. They really are trained to that upper level. And as many times as I probably don't see eye to eye with the nursing board on credentialing, I do. It's important that when we trust, and nursing is the whole aspect of care. The physicians, you know this, the physicians do a lot of work, but the nursing part of it carries it out. And the nurses have to come in and figure out, know the families and tons of things. They give you the medications. And we want them to be the best of the best. And I truly, truly believe, just because my own experience with nursing and when I worked with the nurses, that Minnesota has the best. And to be the best, like Top Gun, I'm going to call them Top Gun nurses, they have to go through a rigorous time to get credentialed in Minnesota. When you have a credentialed Minnesota nurse, you know you have a really good person caring for you. I haven't seen that in other states. I've seen it in Minnesota as a provider as well as a patient. And again, maybe I'm biased because I probably won't be able to go home if I didn't say this, but the truth is that I don't think that's really biased. I think it's what my own personal experience is working with them. And I get it. To fix the staffing shortage, maybe we got to up the staff at the board. Maybe we got to do things with our own regulatory arm as far as making it better. But to cut regulations is, anytime we do that, we're settling. And so I respect your position. I respect what you want to do here, but I still can't get behind this bill. So thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Zuskar. I'm getting better at that name.
Yes, you are. Yes, you are. Other questions, discussion from members? Representative Nadeau.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Representative Zalesnikar, for bringing this bill. You know, I was reading the things in the packet on this, and you know, it's kind of a surprise to me that there's a lot of supporters. And you know, we talked last year about the number of vacancies that hospitals have and the inability to serve, and I appreciate all the work that the Minnesota Nurses Association does, but I don't see how this bill is anything more than allowing nurses to practice waiting for the licensure. And I agree. It is, there's a lot of issues that go into it, be it background checks, be it whatever. And I spend a lot of time in hospitals, and they're trying to get people in the door to serve the populations. And there's all kinds of reasons. There's too many people in our hospitals today, for sure. But I appreciate you bringing this bill. Does it solve all the problems that we have? No, it doesn't. But you know what? It goes in the right direction at the right time to try to get those things done. And I don't know if this is going to take pressure off healthcare CEOs, like this letter states. I can't see how this would have. Let me ask you this. I'm assuming you've met with the Nurses Association. Have you talked to them about how this would take pressure off healthcare CEOs? Does this bill have anything to do with healthcare CEOs?
Representative Zalesnikar.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, members. I met with the Board of Nursing, and spent a lot of time with the Board of Nursing. And this was a really big issue during the pandemic. And right now they tell me licenses are moving and I'm not getting calls. Their licenses are moving more timely. And that's great. There have been additional resources allocated to Representative Hewitt's point, which is wonderful. The reality is that good policy means you plan for the future so that if we're ever in a pandemic or state of emergency for any reason, that we allow 90 days. Because that the patient care is what we're talking about. These are licensed nurses. Minnesota graduates about 4,000 nurses in this state. University of Minnesota, all the colleges in Duluth. We have great nurses that have to wait for the same process that were sitting on the sidelines during the pandemic when we could have used them being supervised as a temporary nurse license helping patient care. And that's what we're really talking about. And so when you look at the fact that we're the only state in the entire union that has a 60-day, we're not looking out for the patient. So this bill is about taking care of the patient. And we have, you know, right now in the state of Minnesota, 134,000 RNs, 13,000 nurse practitioners, and 17,000 LPNs. They want to have people that have went to nursing school by their side in a state of emergency or not. And so all this does is allow 90 days. I think this is very reasonable to your point. And the Board of Nursing didn't have any concerns about it. They saw that they understood what the intent is, to make sure that if we're ever in a pandemic, that we can make sure patient care is paramount.
Representative Nadeau.
Thank you, Representative Zalesnikar. Thank you, Chair Backer.
Okay. Any other? Oh, Representative Gilman.
Thank you so much, Chair. I was just curious if the testifier could come back to the table. I have a quick question.
Okay, yes, go ahead.
If you wouldn't mind.
Go ahead, Representative Gilman.
Thank you, Chair. So my question is this. I was just curious, when do nurses join the union? Do they decide to join the union right from college? And they're already going in, or do they usually get established in their job and then they decide to join a union? Just curious about that.
Go ahead. Pull out Ruth.
Yes.
Oh, thank you. Go ahead.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Representative. So a lot of time the nurses, so
say a nurse graduates nursing school, she passes her NCLEX, and then in the state of Minnesota, so then she's fully able to work. And then wherever she decides, or that person decides to get a job at, if the facility itself is unionized, so that's one way to become a union nurse. And then there's other ways where people can unionize in their own facilities if they choose to. But it's not something that you just go and sign up for a membership in. you get a job where it's already unionized, and yeah.
Okay. Representative Gilman, follow up?
Yeah, thanks. I'll just follow up really quick. Just going, again, when we talk about this being an anti-union bill, I don't believe it would be anti-union, because you need more nurses in the field to be able to make decisions in the trades, like if they want to choose unions, or if they want to, you know, stay, I don't know if you'd say in the free market or just non-unionized, but their end goal, again, what I love about nurses is they get to make decisions, but we need them out there. We need them practicing. We need them with the patients. And instead of looking at, you know, the profits over patients, I think the biggest thing is to incentivize and encourage as many nurses as possible from our state to go serve. And it's a beautiful thing. I personally was going to be a nurse. That is what I wanted to do as an 11th grader, until I heard there's possibility of weekends and holidays and even evenings, overnights. And so I went into the dental world instead. But I appreciate all the nurses, and I think I'm really grateful for this bill, because, again, it's a policy. It's a look at 30 days, and the more people that we could get in to serve and have that experience with patients, we should then, I think, be encouraged, if we're union or non-union, to be excited that Minnesota is going to help support those in need. So thanks.
Okay. Did you have a comment?
Sure, if I can.
Yeah, you may.
Thank you, Chair and Representative. So to that's a really very multifaceted response, but I'm going to do my best. So as most nurses, just like yourself, wanting to serve people, you know, many representatives here all of us nurses going to becoming a nurse because we're really passionate about what we do, right? I was 5 years old, and I knew I wanted to become a labor and delivery nurse. Every single one of us really has a passion and love for taking care of our communities and everybody in it. To answer your question about why there's a number of reasons why you're going to see several deficits in different areas. And one thing that we can say is that when nurses have a voice and are able to have a voice in their workplace, and where they can say, you know, I do good work, I work really hard, and being able to receive benefits that are good, pay, safe standards, workplace violence standards, things like that. That's what unionizing does. And so when nurses become a unionized nurse, that's what they are looking to do, is really being able to have that voice, to be able to say, this is what I would like to have, work-life balance, workplace safety, all those kinds of things. So that's sometimes why nurses choose to become part of the union, because of those things. They want to be able to have that. As a new grad, I can say that I worked in a nursing home. As a new grad, I had anywhere between 18 to 20 patients at a time. It's really unsafe. So when we talk about really providing that safe patient care, that this is why nurses want to be able to have a say in that and how they deliver that care.
Okay, I'm going to let you have the final word, and then we're going to turn it over to the author. So, Representative Gilman.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you so much for sharing your experience. Again, I just think this bill, what it does is bring more nurses and more voices and more care for Minnesotans, and I'm just really excited that we can have this bill today. So thanks so much.
Okay, thank you so much. Representative Zalesikar, could you please close on your bill?
Sure. Thank you, Chair Backer and members. I spent a lifetime trying to support healthcare system. I have friends, family members that are nurses, and at some point, you may be a patient in the hospital. I have been during breast cancer. I had 8 surgeries before the pandemic, and so this was something I was highly in tune to, the fact that I was trying to make it make sense that we had graduates from Minnesota that were nurses sitting on the sidelines who had all their paperwork in timely, sitting on the sidelines at a hospital. While they could have been on the floor helping their patient, they were doing paperwork, just sitting in an office, very frustrated that they were hired and couldn't work to help people. And that was not the experience I had as a patient through 8 breast cancer surgeries just before the pandemic, and I wanted to make sure we're never in that again. So this was a pretty simple fix that I worked with the Board of Nursing, and I also looked at what we're doing in all the other states. And when I learned that Minnesota has 60 days, and 90 days just gives us the certainty to keep them on the bedside with their fellow colleagues under supervision to make sure patient care is not jeopardized more than it needs to be. And so I think this is common sense. It protects Minnesotans in all scenarios, which is what we all deserve, and it gives the support to the fellow colleagues on the floor that are nurses that want to have quality care happen too and don't want somebody doing paperwork that could be working side by side. So members, I urge you to vote yes for a very reasonable, safe, and accountable bill. Thank you.
Thank you, and we appreciate those comments. We won't be voting yes or no because we're laying this over, but we appreciate your enthusiasm. So the chair lays over House File 499 for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill. So thank you, Representative. We turn to Vice Chair Nadeau. Now, as Representative Nadeau moves to the table, the chair moves House File 794 before the committee with the chair's intent to lay the bill over. Representative Nadeau, when you're ready, introduce your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I also have an amendment that I would like to move.
Okay, so moved. So, yeah, so Representative Nadeau offers the A1 amendment to get the bill in the shape that the author would like. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. All those opposed say nay. The motion prevails, and the A1 amendment is adopted. Okay, to the bill as adopted.
Thank you.
Or amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Thanks for hearing this bill today. I'm bringing House File 794 today because every one of us knows someone whose life has been touched by dementia. A parent, a grandparent, neighbor, a friend. Over the past 5 years, the Minnesota Department of Health has estimated the number of Minnesota seniors living with Alzheimer's has increased by 20%, and the rates of adults experiencing cognitive decline are occurring at an even higher alarming rate. Alzheimer's is a disease that doesn't just impact the person who's diagnosed. It reshapes the lives of entire families. Those families are often left navigating a confusing maze of services and support with no clear path and no one to guide them on the process. Right now, there's no one in state government or county government or local government whose job is solely to focus on dementia, and families deserve better than that. They deserve someone who's paying attention, someone who understands a fuller picture, and work proactively to make sure that the programs that we currently have connect in a way that makes sense to the people they serve, eliminate redundancies, and make sure that our resources, both human and financial, are working in unison. This bill creates a single point of leadership within the Department of Health so that we can do a better job of supporting those living with dementia and the people that care for them. This isn't about growing government. It's about making government work better for the people who need it the most. I'm so grateful for the Alzheimer's Association for the work that they do on this issue, and I want to turn it over to my testifier right now to share more about the real impact this bipartisan bill can have for Minnesota families. And before I turn it over, I want to thank all the members on this committee that have signed on to this bill, Representative Bierman, Representative Schumacher, Representative Ryer, Representative Perryman, Representative Elkins, Representative Hemmingson-Yeager, Zalesnikar, and Purcell. So thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'd like to turn it over to Mr. Freeman.
Thank you so much. Mr. Freeman, state your name and ask you to keep your comments to roughly 3 minutes.
I'll try and do that. Happy St. Patrick's Day, everyone. Good afternoon, Chair Backer and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Robert Freeman. I'm the Vice President of Public Policy for the Minnesota North Dakota chapter of the Alzheimer's Association. Our mission is to lead the way to end Alzheimer's disease and all other dementia by accelerating global research, driving risk reduction and early detection, and maximizing quality care and support. Thank you so much for the opportunity to testify in support of House File 794, bipartisan legislation which would establish a dementia services program at the Minnesota Department of Health. Alzheimer's disease and other forms of dementia are one of the most complex and expensive public health challenges we face today. As you can see from the handout in the packets, more than 100,000 Minnesotans are currently living with dementia, and that number is growing rapidly. And we're spending about $1 billion a year on this disease just in Minnesota, which will affect 1 in 10 seniors. A study in The Lancet in 2020 suggested up to a third of dementia cases are preventable. Yet today, there's no one single person within state government, as Representative Nodo said, whose full-time job is to focus on reducing the incidence of dementia and providing services for those whose lives are currently impacted. This bill doesn't create a new program of bureaucracy, it creates clarity and coordination. Right now, dementia-related work is scattered across multiple departments, agencies, and community organizations, often with little or no communication between them. The result is inefficiency, duplication of efforts, and missed opportunities to better serve families and caregivers. A dedicated dementia programs manager will help connect those dots. This position will have a line of sight into the various programs and funding streams that touch dementia, ensure better coordination and smarter use of existing resources. And Minnesota wouldn't be alone in taking this step. 29 other states, red and blue, have already recognized the value of a dedicated point person on dementia. In other states, we've also seen these positions have been instrumental in leveraging federal and philanthropic dollars that can also help bolster communities' dementia services as well. We're behind, and this is a fiscally responsible step to take to catch up and make sure our public dollars are working as efficiently as possible to provide the best services for our constituents whose lives are impacted by dementia. I want to thank Representative Nadeau for his leadership for authoring this bipartisan legislation, and our other House authors who he listed, many of whom are in this room today. This bill is also supported by the Long-Term Care Associations, AARP, Catholic Charities, Minnesota Areas on Aging, Elder Justice, Lutheran Social Services, Minnesota Home Care Association, Volunteers of America, and numerous other organizations who work in this space to help elder Minnesotans. Please support House File 794 and help improve dementia services for Minnesotans. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Turn it over to the public. Anybody from the public would like to speak on behalf of this bill? Okay, seeing none, turning over to members' discussions. Questions for the author? Okay, wow. Oh, okay, Representative Bierman, go for it.
Thank you, Representative Nadeau, for bringing the bill forward, and Mr. Freeman for being here to testify on it. I was just wondering, could you comment on, like, if this funding goes through and you get the point person set up? I know there's talk about outreach and so forth in the bill, but what are some of the, you know, top line priorities you would see would be most effective using this funding?
Yeah, that's a great question,
Mr. Freeman.
Oh, sorry.
Go ahead.
Sorry, Mr. Chair.
That's okay.
That's a great question, and I know that the folks from the Department of Health are here today, too, if you have more technical questions. So I think some of the things that we see are really just having line of sight into those different organizations and in the community around the state that are working on these issues but might not necessarily be talking to each other. So, for instance, let's say an organization in Apple Valley wants to create an organization to help people with Alzheimer's disease, and they say, we should set up a helpline. And the Alzheimer's Association already has a helpline, so we wouldn't want to duplicate that. We could use that money for something else more valuable. But also, as we kind of enter kind of the era of treatment with Alzheimer's, and we have, you know, now we have FDA-approved medications that can help slow down the progress. We're also going to want to work more closely with our healthcare systems to make people aware of those and make sure that folks are, you know, getting access to that treatment as well. And then there are, I think, other opportunities that have been identified in the Department of Health's, you know, Healthy Brain Initiative plan to address Alzheimer's and dementia too, and some of the you know, inconsistencies and difficulties that have been in communicating between the different parts of state government.
Okay, follow up?
Yes, please. So, you know, I think about Alzheimer's and I meet people who are struggling with that in their home with their loved ones, and they're not really connected to anything else. And so I think that's building that connection. And, you know, it's also, as we've talked in the past, it's sort of a stigma, and people try to almost hide it to some level. And I think that that's going to be a challenge going forward to kind of get people the support they need when they need it. And it can make a world of difference for the patient and the caregivers. So I appreciate the bill. Thank you, Representative Nadeau, for carrying it forward. I just think, as you mentioned in your statement, you know, this is something that's not, it's just going to be more numbers going ahead. So thank you both.
Okay, seeing no further discussion from members, Vice Chair Nadeau, please close on your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, and thank you, Representative Bierman. You know, Minnesota put together a strategic plan to address dementia in 2022, and I see this position as being one that can start implementing those, and families that have lived with families that have lived with people with Alzheimer's, is the trajectory of that decline is difficult to pay attention to and to know what comes next. And I think that this position is going to really do a lot to help those families kind of know what's ahead as families lose the resources of the parents, and they move into MA and they move into higher levels of services. You know, there's so many people that just don't understand that trajectory. So I really thank you for supporting this bill.
Okay, thank you so much. Thank you. The chair lays over House File 794 as amended for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Thank you, Vice Chair Nadeau and Mr. Freeman. Okay, we are now, folks, on House File 837. So as the author of the bill comes to the table, the chair moves House File 837 to Ways and Means. With that said, Chair, introduce your bill when you're ready.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the Health Committee. Representative O'Driscoll and the chief author of the reinsurance reauthorization bill. I want to give you a little bit of background of how we got here to today, March 17th, and why this is important and why it's before the Health Committee. Back in 2013, the Affordable Care Act was passed, and prior to that, Minnesota had a very robust individual market. If someone went to an insurance company for health insurance and was declined coverage, they would take that declination letter, provide it to MCHA, the Minnesota Comprehensive Health Insurance Association, and MCHA would place that person with a insurance company. And they would pay more premiums than they would if they were underwritten in the conventional market. But what has happened is with the ACA, kind of dismantled that program here in the state of Minnesota. And in 2016, we realized that we were about ready to lose the individual market here in the state of Minnesota. What's the individual market? It's where people buy insurance when they're not employed and they don't get insurance coverage through their employer, or they're not Medicare eligible or financially meeting the criteria for Medicaid. It's kind of everybody else who was left over in that market. It might be individuals who retired early. It might be individuals who are unable to work, who have extenuating health circumstances and are purchasing insurance. Or it might be a family who's in transition from one job to another to provide coverage and care for those individuals. In 2016, we had a number of insurance companies in the individual market file to leave that space, which meant that there would be a large gap in insurance available in the state of Minnesota. What is also was discovered at that point, those companies that were staying were only going to be able to maybe be in one or two counties. Excuse me, let me rephrase that. There may only be one or two options available in counties in the state of Minnesota, and some were given no options whatsoever from the individual market. And what the state of Minnesota did is they stood up what was called a reinsurance program. And that program worked in partnership with the health insurance companies in the state of Minnesota to provide reimbursement to the insurance companies for high-risk individuals. And it made a lot of sense to do it that way because the efficiencies were already there with the billing codes and the interactions that the insurance companies had with the healthcare providers. And the idea was that there would be a risk sharing and preserve this marketplace for over 100,000 individual policies. And you kind of hear from different people, it's maybe 97,000 on up to maybe as close to 200,000, depending upon how you classify the individual market. But what has happened is we've been able to stabilize that market, and we've been able to introduce into that market predictability and peace of mind for individuals. It is expensive. There is no question about it. However, if we decide in Minnesota that we don't want to renew the reinsurance program, those really aren't cost savings for us. They're displacement of costs. Because what ends up happening is an individual who's covered under the MinSure program or the individual market, when they can no longer afford their premiums, they will go without insurance. And if they suffer a catastrophic loss, they will have medical bills that will most likely cause them to file bankruptcy, lose their wealth, and put them and their family on the Social Safety Network program. The reinsurance program works to try to stabilize that and to prevent that displacement of individuals in various communities here in the state of Minnesota. The important thing to remember about the reinsurance program as well is that the premiums to start out with are not cheap in the individual market. There is no economies of scale. There is no way to be able to look at a group of people and to be able to make a determination about what those premiums should be, like you might be in a work group. If you are a large company and you go to the insurance company and you say, we have 3,000 employees, they're able to spread that risk over that pool of people and be able to predict pretty closely what the insurance premiums need to be able to provide the coverage for the medical losses that would be incurred by those employees. The individual market, about 6 weeks ago, I sat down, I went to MinSure, I pulled up a silver plan for a person who is about 55 years of age, or on that age, a male, and the premiums were $750 a month. Built into that is federal tax credits that are due expire this year. Built into that is the Minnesota Reinsurance Program, which attempts to buy down those premiums by 20%, set to expire this year. It's estimated that premiums for those folks in the individual market will go from where they are now, my example, $750, up to about $1,100, $1,100 a month. Almost a $5,000 increase on the individual person. Can you imagine if that was a family plan? The cost to cover a family. If we don't go through with the reinsurance program, even though the deductible for that plan that I was talking about is $8,000 a year, and the total out of pocket, which means when you meet your obligation with deductible and your copays and coinsurance as an individual of almost $11,000, then the insurance kicks in. The reinsurance program prevents people from being destitute. There are a number of different plans and ideas floating around out here about how we should fund that. The bill that's before you, House File 837, I wanted to get this plan moving and get this moving. My goal is to get it to the Ways and Means Committee and then have us look at it as a legislature about what is the best option that's available. In the bill right now, it talks about using general funds. There have been a number of, again, options that have been out there. Representative Elkins sits on the Commerce Committee, and he and I both are on the Commerce Committee. And he is going to be bringing some amendments today forward to talk about different options. It is not my intentions nor my wish to adopt any amendments to this. My goal is to get it to the Ways and Means Committee so we can take a look at the various options and find a way to be able to make this plan sustainable. Folks, again, I want to emphasize something. If you think that this problem goes away by not funding this, let me tell you the ramifications. Poverty for individuals, unpaid health care expenses for clinics and hospitals, closure of clinics, closure of hospitals. Last year, my final thought, Mr. Chair, last year in the Commerce Committee, we had heard about Fairview and some of the problems that Fairview was having and how they were hanging in the balance of being solvent. Can you imagine if Fairview Hospitals and Fairview System closed here in the state of Minnesota because they received a bunch of bills that were unpaid or uncompensated because people didn't have any kind of insurance at all? That affects you, that affects me, that affects everybody in the state of Minnesota. This is ground zero in helping us to preserve a viable health care insurance program in the state of Minnesota. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Thank you, Chair. We are turning over to the testifiers. We have quite a few. I'm going to ask the testifiers to keep their comments to 2 minutes. And with that, we have Dan Anderson first. Then Sydney Speck, hopefully I have that right, next, and then Bentley Graves after that on deck. So with that, please state your name and no more than 2.5 minutes, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Dan Andreessen with the Minnesota Council of Health Plans. Thank you for the opportunity today to testify in support of House File 837. Minnesota's reinsurance program has been a resounding success since stabilizing the individual market and bringing premiums down by 20%. Through a federal partnership, funding partnership with the federal government. Since the start of the program, Minnesota has been ranked number one or two for having the lowest premiums in the country, according to Kaiser Family Foundation's list of average premiums by state. An advantage of the program is that its benefits are visible to everyone who enrolls in insurance. No one needs to apply for a special program, and everyone buying in the insurance product on the individual market benefits. The state uses an attachment point model, meaning that the program only subsidizes 80% of enrollee claims between $50,000 and $250,000. All claims above or below this threshold are paid entirely by the health plan. Health plans submit claims to the state, and once federal matching funds are received, the state makes payments to health plans 12 to 18 months after the health plan had already paid that claim. Now, even though the payment is retrospective, since health plans know the subsidy is coming, they're able to account for this in their rates and lower their premiums. Now, we hear a lot of misinformation about this program and that this is a bailout for insurance companies and they're keeping this money. This is a subsidy for patients who and keeping money in the pockets of your constituents that they otherwise be paying in premiums. The money passes through health plans because we're the ones processing the health claims. Reinsurance money is being paid to the endocrinologist who is treating somebody with diabetes, the oncologist who is helping somebody battle cancer, or the cardiologist who is treating somebody with a heart condition. 100% of reinsurance funds are being used to pay medical claims for chronic conditions. No reinsurance money is being kept by insurance companies for administrative costs. Reinsurance payments are summarized in quarterly and annual reports performed by an independent actuarial firm and posted publicly online. This alone is the number of reports that were done for plan year 2023. Reinsurance is one of the most transparent audited programs in the state, and everything you would need to know is in one of these reports. These reports show how much is spent and where is being spent. It includes a breakdown on reinsurance payments by health plan and their product, and you'll see in the report that's in your packets that only nonprofit insurers are receiving reinsurance payments. No for-profit insurer is in the reinsurance program. The report also breaks down payments by meta level, plan type, exchange status, claim spend, geographic rating area, and which chronic conditions are being subsidized. High medical costs for over 4,200 patients were subsidized in 2023, including people living with diabetes, asthma, heart conditions, rheumatoid arthritis, cancer, and more. Now, as for funding, the state has historically used general fund and healthcare access fund dollars for this program. Both of these funds are supported by a broad-based set of taxes on many entities, including health insurers who contribute over $600 million annually to the state budget. In addition, health plans pay an assessment to help fund Medicare and hold $1 billion in payment delays in the Medicaid program to stabilize the state budget. Health plans are already helping to pay for the reinsurance program by paying into the state budget, which is a source of program funding.
And if you can finish up, please.
Yep. We recognize the level of funding is significant, but the benefit is also significant, and we thank Representative Driscoll for his leadership. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Ms. Spinkey? Spreck. Okay, sorry for that. Then Mr. Graves, and then we're going to have Dr. Crago on Zoom. So please state your name correctly for me, for us, in 2.5 minutes or less, please.
Chair Becker and committee members, for the record, my name is Sydney Spreck, and I am a political affairs coordinator at Minnesota Association of Professional Employees. MAPE is a union of over 18,500 state workers across all Minnesota agencies, boards, and commissions. Thank you for the opportunity to share our concerns about HF 837. Minnesota is already a national outlier in the amount it has spent on public subsidies for its reinsurance program, and this bill would continue this trend, giving $413 million to private health insurance companies. Initially created as a temporary stopgap measure to stabilize the individual health insurance marketplace, the reinsurance program has instead become a reliable corporate subsidy. Most states pay for reinsurance through fees on the insurance companies, similar to what is proposed in the governor's budget, not funding from their state general funds. Minnesota families cannot afford to have insurance companies subsidized by their tax dollars when so many other public programs are underfunded and in jeopardy. The estimated cost of continuing reinsurance is more than the budget surplus projected in the current biennium and would add on to the coming structural deficit. Minnesotans deserve real solutions to health care access, especially with federal funding uncertainties that could impact health care programs like Medicaid and MinnesotaCare. I urge you to oppose this bill and to consider reinsurance options that put the cost burden on the health insurance companies, not on the backs of Minnesotans. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Then Mr. Graves, and then Dr. Crago on Zoom, and then Ms. New Brindley is after that. So go ahead, Mr. Graves.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Bentley Graves with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. We support the continuation of the state's individual market reinsurance program because it's brought stability to the individual market. For context, we should look back to September 30th, 2016, when Commissioner of Commerce Mike Rothman issued a press release announcing the 2017 premiums for the individual market. Here's what he said. For the seven insurers in the individual market, the 2017 rate increases range from 50 to 67%. The individual market's largest insurer, covering 103,000 Minnesotans, about 40% of the state's total market, was forced to leave due to ongoing financial losses, and enrollment caps were instituted to address the concerns of the remaining in the market. As Commissioner Rothman put it in his release, Minnesota's individual market for 2017 was on the verge of collapse. In explaining the reasons for the turmoil, the commissioner noted that the rate increases were at least in part reflective of a national trend, but he also went on to note the following. Quote, Minnesota's individual market also faces unique challenges because of a disproportionate concentration of individual serious medical conditions whose high claims cost must be absorbed by a relatively small risk pool, pushing up rates for everyone in the individual market. The commissioner urged quick action, and fortunately, the governor and the legislature in a bipartisan manner took action and established the state's reinsurance program to lower premiums and stabilize the market. It did this by addressing the unique problem identified by Commissioner Rothman. The program leverages state and federal funds to help pay for the high-cost claims of the sickest individuals in the market, taking these costs out of the calculation of rates and lowering costs for everyone in the market. As a result, thanks to reinsurance, in 2025, we now have the second lowest individual market premiums in the country in a stable, growing market. The Department of Commerce reports that premiums in the individual market are about 25% lower than they would otherwise be without reinsurance, and we know that rates would increase significantly for the next 2 years if state funding for the program is not provided this session. So we thank Representative O'Driscoll for bringing this bill forward. We ask the committee to support its passage because with the value of hindsight and the proven track record of our reinsurance program, we can help ensure continued stability in the individual market and help ensure we don't return to those troubling and challenging days of 2016-2017 when, quote, Minnesota's individual market was on the verge of collapse. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Thank you, thank you. And now we go to Zoom to Ms. Craigo, and then after that will be Ms. New Brindley, and then Mr. Anderson. Okay, go ahead.
Thank you, Chairman Backer, committee members, and good afternoon. I'm Paula Craigo. I'm a retired physician, I'm Dr. Craigo, and anesthesiologist from Rochester, Minnesota. For over five decades, I have cared for sick and injured people. I've seen families devastated by illness and accident. First, there's the slam of the disease itself, and the financial damage follows. And running through the entire process is a back and forth struggle with the insurance company. I've got family members who see denial of coverage by health insurance companies as just the first step in a nasty back and forth. Let's just see who gives up first. Friends who have survived cancer weave that same theme through their memories. Yes, I was flat on my back fighting with the insurance company, and he said, or then the insurance company denied coverage, so we... It is critically important that our tax dollars support Minnesota residents, not corporations. The visuals are really hard to explain away to the voters. Currently, Minnesota projects a small budget surplus followed by deficits. Since 2017, over $1 billion of our tax money went to this industry through reinsurance. Now we're adding over $504 million more. Reinsurance was a temporary bridge, not a permanent solution. Minnesota spends much more than the other states do on their reinsurance, and we take it from our tax dollars, which most of the other states don't. The health and well-being of Minnesota residents is already under threat and attack from increasing insurance premiums, as well as loss of federal money to Minnesota Care, and who knows what else as this goes on. I urge you to require the insurance companies to bear the cost burden of the reinsurance to cover at least part of that, or to find another source entirely, as the governor has proposed. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Next is Ms. New Brindley, then Mr. Anderson, and then Ms. Krinke. State your name in 2.5 minutes, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Good afternoon. I'm Ann New Brindley. I'm the Health Policy Director with the Minnesota Business Partnership. So the Minnesota Business Partnership represents business leaders from the state's largest employers who collectively employ nearly 500,000 workers in Minnesota and 4.8 million globally. And Minnesota consistently ranks among the top states for healthcare quality and has one of the lowest uninsured rates in the nation. Our state is also fourth in the country for employer-sponsored insurance and sixth for employer contributions to healthcare costs. Every Minnesota Business Partnership company offers employer-sponsored healthcare. So you might begs the question, why does the Minnesota Business Partnership care about reinsurance? However, affordability, access, and equity in healthcare are key priorities for our members. Reinsurance has been an important piece of the puzzle in stabilizing Minnesota's individual insurance market and the broader health ecosystem across the state. Without its extension, premiums could increase by 25% or more, leaving tens of thousands of Minnesotans without affordable coverage. Such a significant rate hike would not only put coverage out of reach for many, but it would also likely lead to substantial budget shortfalls for healthcare providers and drive up insurance rates in the commercial market. And that creates widespread instability across the healthcare ecosystem. Not only do Minnesota Business Partnership members care about their neighbors and making sure that all Minnesotans have access to affordable coverage, but they also understand that moving almost 100,000 people out of commercial insurance, the commercial insurance market, leads to more uncompensated care, it leads to higher insurance rates for workers across Minnesota, and worst case scenario, possibly resulting in the closure of service lines or facilities, leading to less access for everyone in Minnesota. I understand that there are significant questions surrounding how to fund reinsurance this year. And I would just make sure that everybody understands that HMOs and health plans are already taxed in Minnesota at 8.46 and 8.86% respectively. It's been suggested that other states tax their insurers to pay for reinsurance, but I would also make sure that you look into those programs. Many of those other states also offer tax credits to ensure that, consumers are held harmless when, we increase those taxes. I understand that when reinsurance was first passed in 2017, the hope was that it was going to be a temporary program to stabilize the market while a better solution was found. And the reality is that the program has been really effective at ensuring care for people for whom care is expensive, people with chronic or complex conditions that require consistent care. 18 states followed Minnesota's lead and implemented their own reinsurance programs, and no other state is considering letting reinsurance go away. The Minnesota Business Partnership is committed to supporting affordable, accessible health care for all Minnesotans and a stable health care ecosystem. And reinsurance plays a crucial role in achieving those goals. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Thank you. Mr. Anderson, please state your name and keep it to about 2.5 minutes. We would appreciate that. Go ahead, Mr. Anderson.
Mr. Chair, committee members, good afternoon. My name is Mike Anderson. I'm the past president of the National Association of Benefit and Insurance Professionals in Minnesota, and I'm an independent insurance agent serving individual and families on and off the exchange in Minnesota and employer customers across Minnesota. I'm here today on behalf of the Agents Coalition, which includes the four professional associations in Minnesota. Collectively, we represent over 54,000 licensed insurance agents, and our agents represent about 2.25 million Minnesotans covered by the private market, and we work closely with both group and individual market consumers on a daily basis. We strongly support the extension of the reinsurance program, and we thank Representative O'Driscoll for the authorship of this bill. The individual marketplace is not only where individuals and their families get coverage when they don't have access to employer-sponsored coverage, it's where people get coverage when they start a new business. It's also relied upon by individuals between jobs and early retirees. When the reinsurance program was first implemented, according to the Minnesota Department of Commerce, this plan resulted in premiums being 20% lower in 2018 than without reinsurance. All of the benefits of this program go directly to consumers in the form of lower premiums, as shown through the Department of Commerce rate filings of the carriers, which were filed with and without reinsurance due to the timing of the passage of the reinsurance bill. No funding goes to the bottom line of the insurance carriers, since they can only get reimbursed for actual medical bills by MCHA. They cannot receive reimbursements for their overhead and administrative costs, only actual medical expenses. We are pleased that Governor Waltz included an extension of the reinsurance in his budget. However, we do have significant concerns about the proposed new MCHA tax. We ask that you renew this program with two principles. Provide permanent-based funding so that individuals and small businesses are not subject to uncertainty about the funding every few years, and support a broad-based funding source either from the general fund or the healthcare access fund, and oppose the new MCHA tax, which will be passed through to policyholders not borne by insurance carriers. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you, Mr. Anderson. And then last testifier that signed up is Ms. Krinke. State your name and you've been here once before, so you know what to do. 2.5 minutes, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And for the record, my name is Mary Krinke, and I'm with the Minnesota Hospital Association. We represent 140 hospitals statewide, and I just want to say that we support reinsurance being authorized again and to keep in place. And many good comments have been made, so I just want to point out a couple things from the perspective of hospitals. There is so much uncertainty right now. There's uncertainty in hospital finances. There's uncertainty in what is happening in Washington, D.C., particularly with our Medicaid program. There's uncertainty in our workforce and how we're going to get the next generation of workers in healthcare. And we look at the reinsurance program, and we see it as something that provides stability. And I just really hope that you all realize who is using reinsurance. It is our farm families. It is small business owners. It is individuals that are self-employed. And so it is a large swath of folks in Minnesota. And we just really want people to realize that if this program goes away, it's estimated that costs will go up anywhere between 25% and 50%. We know that this bill, if this bill or a similar bill doesn't pass to keep reinsurance in place, our uninsured rate will rise in Minnesota, hospitals will see more uncompensated care, and our financial struggles will continue. So we are hoping that something gets worked out on reinsurance, and we support this bill. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Thank you so much. I open up for turn it to members of the public. Anybody in the audience that wants to speak on behalf of this bill? Going once, going twice, sold. Okay. Thank you very much. Representative Elkins, I understand you have a one or two amendment. Two, okay.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I have an A3 and an A4, and I'm going to present them and then withdraw them.
Okay, so which one do you want to present first, Mr.?
We can do the A3 and then the A4.
Okay, go ahead, Representative Elkins. On the A3 amendment.
Yeah, okay. On the A3 amendment it set the ground for this. So first of all, I agree with everything that Chair O'Driscoll has said about the program and the necessity of continuing it. The only reason I'm offering these amendments is to get alternative financing proposals out onto the table. So the bill in its current form has a price tag of over $500 million in general fund dollars. And I just don't believe that there's any world in which when the dust settles that commerce or health gets a $500 million general fund allocation as part of the overall budget deal. That's larger than the entire projected surplus that we have for the entire biennium. So the A3, which I'll offer first, is the administration's proposal, which is to assess a 2% assessment on insurance premiums paid to all of the members of the Minnesota Comprehensive Health Association, which is the governing body for the reinsurance plan now. And Julia Dreyer or Sam Smith from Commerce want to testify in favor of that, that would be, I think, entirely appropriate as well. We will see the final math on this when the governor's budget proposal is formally released, but the administration believes that this proposal will generate enough revenue from the surcharge on the MNCHA plan members to cover the necessary amount for the to pay for the continuation of the program in its current form.
Okay. Was there someone wanted to testify to that A3 amendment? You don't have to. This is kind of like phoning a friend. Please state who you are and keep it within 2 minutes.
Sure. Good afternoon. Julia Dreyer, Deputy Commissioner of Insurance at Department of Commerce. Thank you, Chair Becker. Yes, as Representative Elkins noted, the governor's budget proposal does include an assessment on health insurance companies and other related companies that sell health-related products to help fund the reinsurance program. As we've noted in other testimonies, we feel like this is a way for us to be able to continue moving the program forward and get the benefit of the reinsurance program without relying on general fund dollars.
Okay, thank you, Deputy Commissioner Dreyer. Representative Elkins, Representative Bierman, you have a question
just
there,
a quick
Deputy
question.
Commissioner Dreyer.
While the Deputy Commissioner's up there, I just wanted to ask about the governor's plan would fully maximize the federal funding available from reinsurance. So this is a plan that would permit that. Would it also permit, you mentioned the plan itself is on the MNCHA group, but as I understand it, this reinsurance can sort of be written any way a state wants to. So we can kind of add or delete some or all of that funding. It wouldn't have to be just MNCHA, we could mix some other things in there too, is that correct?
Deputy Commissioner Dreyer.
Chair, yes. So as states, to your question about how states structure the reinsurance programs, every state, well, there are similarities between states. Every state's reinsurance program does look a little bit different. So there are ways to modify proposals to meet the state's needs. And can you remind me of your first question?
So that's
Representative Bierman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So that was the first thing, we're maximizing the federal funding that is available.
Yes.
And depending what happens with the administration, whether they go back to the old way, which sort of penalized us on the BHP to some degree, that could be a direct impact to this as well, correct?
I'm sorry. No, go ahead, right. Deputy Commissioner Durant.
Yes, so it's when reinsurance first passed, there was an impact to the basic health plan or Minnesota Care because of how the formulas worked. CMS, or the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, has put forward a fix in rule to address that. Obviously, that's still a concern, and there is language in the governor's budget proposal to address that impact.
One last question.
Yes, Representative Bierman, go ahead.
So when you talk about a design fix, if the federal government goes back to what was done prior to the last administration and fix that, and then if they revert to their original, then there's a cost, an additional cost to the state of Minnesota because we're making the fix. Is that right?
Deputy Commissioner Dreyer.
Chair, no, at that point there wouldn't be funding available for reinsurance. So if the federal government takes away the BHP funding or addresses the BHP funding, at that point we're saying the reinsurance program would blink off.
Thank you.
Okay, Representative Perryman.
Thank you, Chair. My question would be, has there been a decision or do you know what plans will be taxed or assessed in the program?
Chair, Representative, yes, so it is, the proposal has it being all MCHA members, so members of the Minnesota Comprehensive Health Association. So it's roughly 300 organizations.
Okay, follow up, Representative Perryman.
No, thank you.
Okay. Is there any other further questions for the Deputy Commissioner? Oh, Chair.
Before Representative Elkins, thank you, Mr. Chair. Before Representative Elkins withdraws his amendment, there are some things I'd like to share about his proposal as well.
Okay,
cool. The administration.
Sure, go ahead about the A3 amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And the proposal that the administration is putting forward does increase the tax on insurance companies, which, as a previous testifier said, already exists. And that can be problematic because as the people who are Minnesota is their home state, what we call in the insurance industry, domiciled in the state of Minnesota. When they go to other states to sell products, they would be subject to whatever the tax is in not only Minnesota, but in other states. So if we are to increase the tax in Minnesota by, say, 2 or 3%, when those products are sold in other states, those states will collect, based on the premiums collected in those states, an additional tax that's literally leaving the state of Minnesota and going to these other states for the privilege of selling our products in other states. So it's beyond what the governor's proposal is. Dare I say, it's almost like an insurance tariff that other companies or the other states would be levying against insurance policies and premiums here in the state of Minnesota. If the governor is allowed to, or I should say if Minnesota goes forward with the governor's tariffs, if you will, on the insurance premiums. And to Representative Perryman's question, you know, who's covered in there? All the MCHA members. So it's the health insurance providers, which is typically the nonprofit that we're talking about. But it extends to disability insurance carriers, which have no interaction with health insurance and premiums and coverage, to long-term care, which has no interaction with health care and premiums and coverage of care. And it also goes on to a duck that we're all familiar with that kind of walks around on commercials for supplemental income for people who are on disability. So there's a lot of other organizations that are affected by this who literally do not have any skin in the game on providing health insurance coverage, or I should say health insurance reimbursement for coverage by qualified providers that are covered in that network. I just wanted to talk about that. As I said, there are several plans that are floating around. We heard some of the, from Representative Bierman, some of the limitations on reinsurance, but this is also another limitation that's on the plan that we're bringing more people to the table who actually don't have skin in the game. And Minnesota may be subjecting themselves to litigation because of taxation without any kind of participation by those companies. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Chair. Any further discussion on the A3 amendment?
No, then, Mr. Chair, I'd like to withdraw the A3 amendment and offer the A4 amendment.
Okay, Representative Elkins, please offer the A4 amendment. And if you just can get a tad bit closer to that mic, sure. Representative Doe's having problems hearing.
Okay.
And some other ones are too. So.
Yeah, I have brand new hearing aids, so I
no,
I
no, no problem.
I can relate. So the A4 amendment, the genesis of that is that Mr. Harney wrote a really good history of the financing of the reinsurance plan since it was its inception in 27 and 18. And reading through that, I noticed that in 27 and 18, part of the funding to get the program going came from the Healthcare Access Fund, which is financed by the provider tax. In that time frame, the provider tax was actually a part of an overall package deal, was reduced from 2.0% to 1.8%. So I said, and I think out it came to about $200 million in that biennium came out of the Healthcare Access Fund to partially fund the first reinsurance plan. So I went back to Joe and said, Joe, roughly what is a tenth of a cent on that worth? And ballpark, it's like somewhere in the range of $90 to $100 million a year. So I thought to myself, well, what if we just, increase the provider tax back from 1.8 to 2.0%, and then use the extra money to help finance the reinsurance program. So the A4 amendment says that we would, raise the healthcare provider tax from 1.8% back up to 2%, and then appropriate $200 million for the biennium from the Healthcare Access Fund to make a down payment on the cost of reinsurance, so that only the balance of about $300 million would have to come from either the MNSHA tax or the general fund. And again, the objective here is just to make sure that when this bill gets to the room where it happens in Ways and Means, that the negotiators have a variety of funding sources on the table that they could pick and choose from.
Okay, thank you. Because it is an amendment, if there is someone that would like to testify. Okay, if there's anybody that wanted to say a testify from the public. Okay, go ahead. Please state your name and limit it to a minute and a half.
Mr. Chair, members, Dave Renner of the Minnesota Medical Association. I will try to be very brief. We are also supportive of continuing reinsurance. I'm hoping many of you are not surprised. We would be opposed to increasing the provider tax and using the Healthcare Access Fund. That's a very regressive tax. It does add to healthcare costs, and we don't think that's the appropriate way to use it.
Okay, thank you. We have members with questions, so we are going to go with Representative Nadeau, and then we have Representative Bierman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Elkins. You're always thinking outside of things, and I appreciate the way that you approach. I just wanted to point out, and I know that you're going to withdraw the amendment, but the directed payment program that we're working on for hospitals right now, this would have a severe limit on, we're getting close to the cap that we're able to federally get to, and this would shrink that space that we currently need for that directed payment program. I just wanted to put that out for you so that you know, because that assessment cap is capped, and it would be very problematic for directed payments for hospitals. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you. Representative Bierman, just to kind of lay of the land, we'll go to about 25-2 with this amendment, and then we'll have final discussion on the bill or questions. Go ahead.
Thank you.
And there is another member after you that has a question to Representative Bierman.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative O'Driscoll, for bringing the bill forward. Somebody's got to carry reinsurance. Just dipping my toe into this issue a little further this year, it's very cold in there. So I'm glad you're open to options, though, and I think that's really important as for all of us as we move forward. I just wanted to just clarify one thing, though, and that is what this bill would do. So I understand that it would use taxpayer dollars from the general fund to subsidize health care premiums for some Minnesotans, sort of a hidden tax to Minnesotans for government-funded health care. Is that how you would assess it?
No, the question is for Representative Elkin, because we're still on the A4 amendment.
Oh, we're still on the A4?
We are. Okay, you seem okay, okay.
Note I sent over after the A4.
We misunderstood
I can repeat that question and give you time to think about it.
I want to get the A4 off the floor. Is there questions to the A4 amendment? Any further discussion or questions to Representative Elkin on the A4 amendment? Okay, so.
Mr. Chair, if there's no further questions, I'll withdraw this amendment as well so we can get to the final discussion.
Okay, it seems like people are interested in the final discussion. So, and just like Representative Doe, we do appreciate you thinking outside of the box. So, okay. And then I've been advised that I need to restate that the A4 amendment from Representative Elkin has been withdrawn for the record. Okay, now, if you want to does Representative Bierman need to re-ask that question? Okay,
no.
Chair O'Driscoll, you have the floor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and soon to be Chair Bierman. After 3 o'clock this afternoon, we have our newest member sworn into the legislature. I wrote this bill as quickly as as quickly as I knew that I was going to be the chair of the Commerce Committee. The chairs have always from Commerce dipped their toe into that very cold water as well that you were referring to look for a solution and a plan on here. And so I worked to get this bill up and running, and I needed to have some kind of funding source. Not knowing what the November forecast was going to be, not knowing what the February forecast was going to be, I put in there a marker for the general fund. In every committee, including this committee, and every conversation I've had, Representative Elkins could finish my statement because he's heard it so many times. It is a marker. We know that there are multiple plans and multiple ideas that are out there. The goal is to get it to Ways and Means to be able to look at what's available, different options, different sources on that. Without being able to get it to Ways and Means, we really don't have, we have limit our options on how we can renew and continue this program for a very important group of people in the state of Minnesota, those who are in the individual market.
Representative Bierman, it seems like you have another question.
Yeah, I'll let that one go as stated, but one other question I did have, and I have two actually. So
sure.
Fiscal note, it changed recently, I think, and I just wondered what was the cause of that change. And secondly, and this isn't my second question, I just thought of it though. What changed, and then also, by the time we get to the end of session, do we need another fiscal note to see if it changes again?
Chair O'Driscoll.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair and Chair Bierman. We are already one fiscal note beyond where I'd like to be. The original cost of $413 million in the bill, now slightly over $500 million. I think what happened was, as we continue to sharpen the pencil and dig in and find out what the costs are and the group that we're working with, it's cost drivers that are in there. And again, these are pass-throughs that come from the state to the insurer, who then pays the provider. This money goes through. Basically what's happening is the state of Minnesota is getting a freebie by allowing the companies the ability to take that money and then take it and code it out to the providers in the system that's already in existence. Will we have another fiscal note? I've already, as I said, one fiscal note beyond where I want to be on this. And to cost drivers on here, in the past 2 years, we have had 13 or 14 different additional mandates that hit the individual market that are not necessarily going to be included in those that are covered by ERISA plans and others. They aren't allowed to be mandated in there. And so what happens is every time you add mandates and you drive the cost of insurance up. And those could also be reflected in there. Again, no less than a dozen mandates to insurance have already been introduced into the legislature at this point. And so with the loss of federal credits state of Minnesota's reinsurance program in the balance, and with additional mandates out there, the cost to the individual is going to no doubt continue to go up.
I'm Representative Bierman.
Yes. So and just on mandates, I think it's important for this committee especially to realize that mandates are delivering health care. You know, we had one in a bill a week ago from Representative Torkelson to look at putting a blood check on a certain disease that has come a long way, and now they can identify it and treat it in newborns, which saves lives. And that's what a mandate is. And so I think when I hear mandate, I hear treatment for care that's needed. And so I think that's the pull and, you know, push on this whole debate of healthcare is we have to continue to evolve and to cover things that people need in our healthcare system. And it's oftentimes costs money, sometimes it doesn't. You know, periodontal care on dentistry saves money in the long term, but it had a fiscal note at the front that was 20-some million dollars in a biennium, but it saves double that in 3 to 4 years on conditions that don't exist. Sorry to go on, but that mandate thing, I just have been wanting to answer that to somebody on, and it gets to be you.
So, well, I'm happy, Mr. Chair. I'm happy to respond to that question. Representative Bierman, I tend to agree with you that the mandates provide care and that there is a benefit on there. But what I have a problem with is if we keep putting the cost of those premiums out of the reach of people, the door is closed to them on any other coverage that was in that, plus the mandates that were added. So what do they end up with? Worse coverage than they had before because they can't afford the insurance, they can't afford the care, and that's a cost driver. If we find a way to be able to cover mandates where they don't go on to the insurance premium directly, that's another conversation for another bill on another day. But drivers of cost close the door and the affordability to people, particularly in this individual market.
I'll do one more question.
Representative Bierman.
Someone else can talk a while. But so I'm just looking, you know, like you're talking about, the price is going up for people in Minnesota. They deserve relief from high healthcare costs. But every 2 years, we have to rescue this segment of the healthcare market. And it's costing more every time. You know, 2016, 2017, it was labeled as a bridge. Then another bridge was built, and then another bridge. So should we all just accept this is the norm? Or should we think about something else? I'm worried that we're going to have to get MnDOT involved to inspect all of these bridges because they're all going to collapse upon themselves. And that's kind of how I think about the healthcare system. If we don't make structural change that can address the cost issue, because it's like that saying, and you know, it's the cost, stupid. You know, that's kind of from the political side, but it's the economy, stupid. It's the cost, and that's a problem. And we tend to not focus on that or address issues or ways to get beyond that. We just keep plugging away here. So, and it's particularly bad this year when we're going to do $500 million to cost. And so the question in there was, it's not a very good system. And I'm just wondering, Representative O'Driscoll, how you think about something different that could evolve, because you've been here a while. You've been dealing with this longer than I have. But any thoughts to a different way that we could take up?
Okay. Chair O'Driscoll.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and Chair Bierman. My thoughts right out of the chute are, when we applied to the federal government, we got a 5-year waiver the last time we did this. And a very deliberate decision was made to only fund 3 years, to have it expire now, and put that cost right smack dab in the middle of this biennium. The longer we are able to predict the reinsurance window, 2 years, 3 years, 4 years, 5 years, we get a smoothing on this, because we don't have to keep going back, incurring the administrative costs to go through, figure this out, and the insurance companies have some predictability of how they're going to be moving forward with this. So what would have been the best advice is we would have taken and done 5-year waiver when we received that waiver back in the day, from the Biden administration, and we funded all 5 years of the reinsurance program. You would not be staring at a $500 million price tag for these 2 years. We would have been able to smooth that out over a five-year period of time. And that would have provided this legislature more opportunity to look at other alternatives.
Representative Bierman?
If we have any time, I have a couple more.
We don't have much time,
well,
so.
If anybody else
we do have Representative Elkin. Let's go to Representative Elkin, please.
Just continuing in the same thread, I might have the same question that Chair Bierman might have, but the question is this ever going to change? I would say that we are where we are because it's become a relatively little, small risk pool. It seems to have stabilized. It's not shrinking any further. And so I think it is suffering from an adverse selection process right now. If you look at the diseases that are caused most of the reinsurance claims, there are things like diabetes, congestive heart failure. They're chronic diseases that you know increase in frequency with age. So as the population covered by this under this pool ages, if anything, we will see some growth. I suspect that that's what's driving the growth in the claims right now. But I don't think it reverses unless we find some magic way to increase the size of this particular risk pool.
Okay, any comments on that? Okay, I'm going to turn the question to Representative Nadeau. He will be the last question so we can go to a vote. Go ahead.
Sorry, Representative Bierman. Thank you.
You had plenty of questions, Representative Bierman.
And thank you, Representative O'Driscoll. This is, you know, I don't really call this reinsurance. This is high claims reimbursement that has a direct benefit to those people in that shrinking pool that is only 14.2% of our population today. There's going to be a bill coming that you're going to have the opportunity to expand that pool that I'm hopefully going to be able to get here before it's a complicated a bill that moves our BHP into a QHP, and I want to have that robust discussion about the possibilities of increasing, you know, federal premium tax credits from the feds. So we'll be able to look at that. But you're exactly right. But this is a bill that no one. This is a tough situation. These are it's a small pool with a lot of costs, and if we look at the last report. You know, it was $245 million. It was spent on about 4,600 people, where this pool covered 80% of the cost between $50,000 and $250,000 of claims. And this is not a pool of money that we give back to plans. We give it back based on what the Department of Commerce has negotiated in claims payment. And I don't think any of us want to be here, but here we are. And I promise you, I will work with anybody to try to fix this situation and reduce those costs and improve those outcomes. So, but again, thank you, Representative O'Driscoll, for bringing this bill today.
Chair O'Driscoll, close, please.
Thank you for your time, thoughtful discussion, and I appreciate your support to help get this to Ways and Means so we can keep this alive to help preserve that cornerstone in the insurance industry of the individual market. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
The Chair renews his motion that House File 837 be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed say nay. The motion prevails, and House File 837 is on its way to Ways and Means. Okay, before we close here, just FYI, we had a statement earlier at the beginning of the committee. I just want to also clarify, we posted this hearing last Tuesday, and we did not know any specifics about the Sovereignty Day until last Wednesday. Also, the chairs meet every Wednesday, and we were not informed of the details of today to make any changes or accommodations. So with that, seeing no further business before the committee, our next hearing is Wednesday, March 19th, and Chair Bierman will have the gavel. With that, the committee is adjourned.